like to have family gatherings, and for a number of years they have included the Lobrechts in these gatherings. I only recall two of these parties where we were not the only Anglos present. One of them included his Anglo lawyer and Gus Canales with his Anglo wife. This party of several years ago included Mother and I and was held in our vacant lots under the trees. A barbecue, of course. They had butchered especially for the occasion. The other occasion, the party was booked for the ranch, but had to be sidetracked to the school gym at Polito Blanco on account of rain. Again, Mother attended with me. It was a large affair with most of the courthouse attendants included, not only from Alice, but also Falfurrias and San Diego. Many of the people knew me and remembered me, for I had did work for them. We were always treated very nicely. At the schoolhouse, Mother and I were seated at the honor table alongside the Gonzalez's. Again, Gus Canales and wife and the politicos from our courthouse were also included. I could never figure out how we got there. Almost every year they have at least a small celebration and always include us. And usually the party is in our backyard among the trees. A couple of years ago, Tanner and I were invited down to the ranch. Big barbecue. We, the only Anglos again. Nicely treated as always. It was interesting to watch the people. A large group and all the adults spoke together in Spanish. All the children playing about spoke nothing but English. But there was one change. When an adult called to his children to do something or admonish him over his noisy behavior, he always spoke to the child in English. As soon as the child left, he would quickly return to Spanish with his companion. These parties have always been fun. One time, Mr. Gonzalez seemed a bit quiet and ate nothing. The next day, he was sent to the hospital and underwent a serious operation. Later, while he was recovering, he sent me word by his daughter, "Just hold on. As soon as he got out of this fix, we would hold another party, and he and I would be the only ones that would get to eat." But last October 28, 1979, they held the party to stop Maul. The old gentleman had passed away, and this was for the mother's birthday. Again, a big barbecue, and in our backyard. Gerard, Evelyn, and I invited. We attended again, and the only Anglos present. This party was all of the family connections and friends from all over South Texas. Lots of food, and to my utter amazement, practically no drinking. And that little was only a few cans of beer. It was a nice, happy crowd of people. To top it off, the grandmother and guests were serenaded by a mariachi band. Her daughter lives up the other end of the block, has a son, attends A&I of University at Kingsville. The daughter's name is Emma. The son plays in this band and brought them over to honor her. He played the guitar rune. Note three syllables, accent the first and last syllable. This was a new instrument for me, and I marveled over it. A few weeks ago, the Corpus paper had quite a story about them, and the tape we have on them is not at their best. The first part of the evening, they played more conventionally, and as the evening waned, they got more relaxed, and each did more of his own stuff. But they did sound like the bands we hear on the telly, and were enjoyed. It was comical to see a lot of those middle-aged parents jump out in front of that band with their hands over their heads and emulate the dancers we see on TV when such tunes are played. Of course, they didn't get very far with it on that dirt floor, but they had the spirit, and it was fun. It wasn't till the party was almost over I thought of recording it. The only tape we had was a little short test tape. So here it is. I hope you enjoy it.
Mexico, darling. Mexico.
Thank you.
amor, aparita. A todo alborotado,
alborotado.
Horror de
comeback.
Hoy camino a la locura.
You go to the crazy house.
Aunque todo es tortura.
And you're crazy. I love the chick anyway. They left a long time ago.
Now
the moment comes.
Something
like that. You know the reason why. See, I put attention to the heart.
Okay,
now
is from Ariel. Not dated, but it's from one of my earlier letters to her. So many people have stopped to talk with me and extend sympathy over Dad's passing. I think people really mean such expressions, but coming from so many was a surprise, and so many had remembered Dad. Among these to welcome me home and express condolences was one Chico White, a gentleman of parts, many attainments, emblem point, and color. His position in the community is unique, his philosophy simple, and his disposition as cheerful and sunny as his face is round and ebony hued. As a usual thing, all simple folk are sincere in their expressions of emotions. And very likely Chico meant it when he told me he was sorry to hear that my daddy had died. Coming from him, though, was more or less a surprise, as Chico and I were never friends in the strict sense of the word. Our paths about the little town seldom crossed, and between us had never passed the gay and often pungent banter that usually passes between Chico and his friendly customers. He's a boot black and, on occasion, does a bit of portering in one of the local barber shops. Usually, Chico is a man of much leisure, and the problems of unemployment sit lightly on his kinky head. However, Mrs. Chico is very industrious and usually busy in the laundries of various white folks around the town. He has been here so many years that he's a part of the town. Quietly accepted as he is, and just as obligingly accepting folks as he finds them, along with what goods the gods provide. I do not know where he got his name, maybe given him in his childhood. More likely, some facetious white man tacked it onto him much later in life. Chico is part Mexican, and his name is the common Spanish affectionate or pet term denoting the masculine diminutive. To see him, you would better understand his acquiring such a name. True, he's not a tall man, but ah, that Ponson Corporation to you. You could put two or three of us in a pair of Chico's pants, and in a good stiff breeze, we would rattle around like the beans in the centipodes in the middle of the lagoon. As a young man, Chico was caught in the draft. He never did know just what it was all about. In fact, he is still a bit hazy over it all, a point in common with most of we white folks. But when the white folks told him to come on, Chico, you're going to war, he dutifully did as he was told and must have learned his soldiering well. At least that part where a black boy did as he was told to do and with no argument. Eventually, the officers told Chico the war was over and sent him home, where he arrived much relieved, happy to take over his up life in the old manner. After the war came peace. With peace came Legion. Legion meetings and blowouts meant work. Work spelled Chico. There didn't seem to be any war, but white boys in officer hats came around looking for Chico, and Chico didn't know what to do. So hesitantly he came to attention, saluted, waited for orders. Orders so familiar, a boy might as well be still in the army. Gradually, Chico became inured to the ways of peace, and much talk was being spread around about the bonus. Didn't worry Chico much what the white folks talked about, just so they let him forget the army. When payment time came, the Legion checked all ex-servicemen in the community and, of course, disclosed the fact that Chico had not put in a claim for his bonus. Poor Chico didn't know what it was all about, but another white man with an officer's hat was bothering him, ordering him to report. Yes, sir, Mr. Frank, I be there. But I sure hope it don't take too much time, 'cause I'm powerful busy. Of course, he can neither read nor write. So they explained it to him as much as possible and wrote it all out, then brought him over across the hall to the studio for me to witness his mark. I still don't think he knew what he was doing at the time, but between then and the final payment of the bonus, he became educated. At least, Mrs. Chico knew all about it, and when payment day arrived, Chico had his orders. Collect, pocket, and come straight home. Chico's intentions were good, but in a pinch, his spirit could be so frail. Who would expect the old devil to send a siren in the form of a bewitching, long-legged, high-yaller gal to lure a man into trouble? Besides, it was early, and she wasn't luring him very far, just around the corner wherein Alice passes for a Harlem hotspot. Anybody with as much money as Chico had ought to could buy a lady a bottle of beer, but as the radio says, time marches on. At home, Mrs. Chico sat dreaming of the splendors that bonus was going to buy. At first, she was only quietly expectant, then uneasy, apprehensive, fearful, doubtful, wrathful, and finally, so darn mad, she decided it was time to act. And surely it was that same old devil who whispered in her ears when Chico was with their beautiful 600 smackers. It was up to her to fly to the rescue. She did, in a frenzy it seems, for later she had no recollection of, nor could offer any excuse for grabbing up the old family shotgun as she ran through the door. Nor did she recall loading it with the only shell she could find. Luckily, it happened to be fine birdshot. And surely it couldn't have been her who burst into that quiet room with a wild and raucous whoop leveled the old shotgun and banged away at poor Chico. Fortunately, he had seen her coming, and as she entered, he was very busy leaving by the back entrance. Only, he was too late by about one good jump, and would have been impossible for even the most inexperienced marksman to have missed a target so inviting and the size of the seat of Chico's pants. Such violence, such turbulence, and again, time marches on. Came the dawn, and Mrs. Chico awakened to a morning sun and gazed at her erring spouse. Once more, she experienced the full gamut of human emotions. In turn, she was wrathful, doubting, apprehensive, forgiving, atoning, and knew peace. And her day was filled with much picking of fine birdshot from the round of Chico's anatomy. Ariel asks if one of my stories was made up by me or were they real. Well, Ariel, I couldn't make up such tales if I tried. They were usually happenings that took place in my vicinity and I knew about or was told of firsthand. I have noticed, though, that with the passing of time, I am apt to get some of them a bit garbled, particularly as to names, so bear with me on that. Also, I think there are a couple of repetitions in these tapes. So these next few stories are on the up and up. They are copied from the originals, just as I wrote them to Ariel, and she has them dated 1931. I am using them just as I wrote to her back then. You may notice some repetition of names, but I've explained that. She just sent these to me, and I got them yesterday. These are the real McCoy. There was a tall, lanky cowboy around Fremont, a great deal during our early years, always rode a fine-looking horse, and with the usual trappings. A pleasant, good-natured fellow named Guy Seal. There was a time back there we had no bull on the farm, just milk cows, and along comes a big brame of bull from the Canala Ranch. Jumps the fence and joins our cows. He thought he had found a happy home. Canales wouldn't claim him. They had no Bramas, so he must have come from the King Ranch. I told my troubles to the county agent, and eventually this Guy Seal and another cowboy showed up at the farm to claim our visitors. Sure enough, they could identify the King Ranch brand on him, even though it wasn't too plain, so we were relieved of our Brama bull. The hero of this following story is the same Guy Seal. He belonged in and around Alice and later married into the McGill family. I saw a carload of tourists from Illinois get a thrill the other day. Our city policeman is a regular cowboy, about 6 foot, 3 or 4 in his socks, and usually wears his regular trappings of a big hat, boots, and spurs, but only a time or two have I seen him in chaps. In those times, likely, he was just in from the ranch. He runs some cows on the side. He is a most efficient and at his best in directing traffic along our busy paved streets when mounted on one of his cow ponies. He has several, but his favorite is a little paint pony, very intelligent and highly trained. It is his wont, when not riding, to park his pony along the curb between the cars. The pony will stand there quietly with just the reins trailing to the ground at his head. On this morning, he had parked the pony in front of Joe Seiler's shoe shop, and he stepped inside to chat with Joe. The tourists were parked nearby. One of the boys in Joe's place offered to bet Guy he couldn't call the pony into the store. Guy called the bet and promptly called to his pony. One call was plenty, and the pony climbed up over the 2 foot curb, crossed the sidewalk, and came right on into the store to Guy. Joe said he thought those tourist eyes would pop out. They, of course, hadn't heard Guy call. I'll bet they thought this was a wild and woolly country when even the horses wander through the stores. This was the story just as Joe Seiler told it to me. This is still dated 1931 to Ariel. One of Emma's Muscovy ducks stole out a nest, so she let it set, but slipped a couple of extra eggs under her. She hatched off, and now she has several little Muscovies, and one each white Peking and runner duck. She immediately took them to the lagoon and has reverted to the wild. Didn't see them for days at a time, but the last few days Sonny has been coaxing them and trying to feed them. Emma also set a hen on turkey eggs, and the old hen hatched out and raised seven of them. Emma also had a motherless white baby duck at the time. The baby duck sure wanted a mother bad. Tried its best to join those seven baby turkeys, but the old hen drove it off. Sure funny to watch that duck. It would wait until the old hen would hover its baby turks. Then it would sneak in from behind and crowd in under the head. Gradually it forced its way in until at last the old hen gave up and let the duck join. Today, the baby turks are about as large as the old hen, and she no longer claims them. She has started laying again, but all seven of the little turks and the baby duck continue to trail her all day long. Apparently, that little duck doesn't know he isn't a turkey. Our boys have been playing Tarzan of the Apes. They have learned to travel through the aethel trees from the windmill to the house without touching the ground. It's strenuous exercise, but they seem to get a great kick out of doing it. The distance is about a city block. Aethel is a fast-growing tree, and consequently, the wood's brittle. I fear some broken arms or legs, but so far they have all escaped. Emma had to get rid of her big Muscovy duck, Drake. He was eating little chickens. He would grab a chicken that had just started to feather out, give it a couple of shakes, grab it by the head, and swallow it alive. He sure was thriving. They couldn't bear to kill him, so they took him down to Uncle Joe Lindquist and dumped him in with Joe's ducks swimming in the tank. Later, when her chicks were older, she would bring him home again. Joe now has a whole pond full of these ducks from the start Emma has given him. I asked Joe if he didn't plan on selling or eating some of them. He shifted his quid and answered slowly, "No, I reckon not. They love to see them swimming around and will let them remain unmolested. Get them started and those Muscovies multiply like guinea pigs are supposed to." The San Antonio paper has been running fish stories. This is still 1931. This is one struck my funny bone, and I included it. Two fishermen from San Antonio were down along the Medina River and had run out of bait. They had gone back a ways from the river, hunting for a likely place to dig bait, but could find no worms. They were about to give up in disgust and leave for home when they heard a noise and investigated. The noise came from a small frog that a snake was trying to swallow alive. One of the men yelled, "There's my bait," and grabbing up a small forked stick, he pinned the snake down and retrieved the frog. The other man insisted that it was a dirty trick to rob the snake of his dinner and insisted on giving him a drink to make it up for the loss. So they dropped a few drops from the little brown bottle into the snake's mouth and then went back to fishing. Got back to the river and soon heard that same strange noise again. They looked around and sure enough, there was that same snake looking up at them with another frog in his mouth. Today is the 5th day of May, and we've had no rain since early last fall. Dry, oh, it's dry. They have declared our county a disaster. Crops are lost, our yards dry, but our garden is one of the prettiest gardens we've ever had. But, oh, I do hate to think of the water bill. Tomatoes are ripening, nice big tomatoes. We had potatoes today, green beans, Swiss chard, lots of things like that. Girard figures out a new way to water our garden. He built a tower about as high as his shoulders, put a tin tub on top of that, and on top of that he set a revolving sprinkler that Morris gave us several years ago. Well, this sprinkler revolves and waters the whole garden, and instead of running on the ground, which seems to kind of soak the ground and pack it together, it leaves it loose, and it washes off all the plants, making them nice and fresh, and things sure are marveling. Our big tubs are doing better this year than last year, too. Everything looks nice. The okra isn't growing so fast, but it's coming along. And we ate our... One of the joys of living in a small town in the Midwest was the yearly celebrations the hometowns would put on. Mount Pulaski had two regular celebrations. The first was the 4th of July, of course, and all the old soldiers were honored. And then again, later in the summer, after the oats and wheat had been harvested, the corn laid by, and there was a chance to catch their breath, they pulled off the big celebration, Old Settlers' Day. Yes, in my earliest years, there were a few of them still with us. And, of course, many families who were of the first families of the prairie. As you all know, Mount Pulaski stood on a hill. The top of the hill, a block square, was a city park with the old county courthouse in the center of this park. Everything sloped gently down from this courthouse. The business center was on all four sides of this park, on the opposite side of the street. The streets ran from 5 or 6 blocks downhill in every direction. It was 4 blocks from the southwest corner of the square or park to the railroad station and the tracks, and just across the tracks, the gateway to the best place in town, Obermiller's Baseball Park. The city park had a very wide concrete walk around it. That was fine for promenading. On the inside of this walk was a curbing about 2 feet high. Made a very comfortable seat if you had a cushion. The park was well covered with trees, and in the southeast quadrant stood the town steel reservoir, the tallest in all that country. Right near it was a large drinking fountain. This was a wonderful place for a group of small boys to gather. When they could catch the fountain unguarded and hold a tournament to see who could make the fountain squirt the farthest and at the same time come the nearest to drowning the other squirters. Our first years were the square's park was surrounded by hitching racks, and as all farmers drove to town with horses, that was where they tied up. But with the advent of that sidewalk and automobiles, the horses were shunted to the side streets. But right there at the southwest corner of that park, alongside that sidewalk, there stood that drinking trough for the horses. It filled automatically. I wonder if it's still there. That courthouse served as our post office, and the middle of each block was a street crossing and a walk leading up to the post office door. As you went up the south side and to the right side of the walk was the town's bandstand. On each Wednesday night, starting at 8 until 10, we had a band concert. These commenced the evening of Decoration Day and lasted through the summer till Labor Day. The whole countryside would show up, and the older folk and the families would sit around on those curbs or in their cars facing the bandstand. The young folks promenaded, the boys one direction, the girls the other way. Sometimes they got together and both went the same direction. Gingrey's Candy Store was on the north side, and that's where you got your ice cream sodas and roasted peanuts. Both cost a nickel apiece. Raspa and cones had not yet entered the picture. In the wintertime, we coasted down the hill from the southeast corner going south. It was steep and fast, and The heroes were the coasters who could wind up on the railroad tracks just about four blocks down the hill. Alfred asks a lot of questions for me to answer on these tapes, and some of them will be difficult to get to, but here are a couple of them that I think I can get by on. What did I do to make a living in San Antonio, and how did I happen to come to Fremont? The building trades in San Antonio were very busy at that time. Bricklayers were in great demand, and they had started a school with no tuition. A friend of Dad's, and I forget his name, talked me into going to this school where I learned the art of building fireplaces. On this deal, I was a subcontractor for the labor only, so unions couldn't bother me. All materials were furnished. I bid on the job, furnishing my labor and my help. I stayed busy, and it was reasonably successful. This same friend of Dad's came to me one day and related the saga of Fremont. This saga was really thought up by the old SA and AP Railroad. Again, he sold me on the deal, and it started out all right, but it failed to end up as planned. We enjoyed San Antonio very much, and at first we lived with Ariel only a couple of blocks from Brackenridge Park. While we lived there, you two older boys loved to go there, and after moving to Fremont, you two younger ones joined the family. We went there, and as often as we could get to San Antonio. The biggest attractions were, of course, the zoo and the river. In those days, you were allowed to feed the animals. One day, Charlie and I hit the jackpot. Some of the ostriches had been so foolish as to lay their big eggs right out there in plain sight on the ground. The coast was clear, so we quickly scaled the fence and swiped those two big eggs. We had them a long time, and I wonder what finally became of them. Over on the west side of the park, they had a polo grounds, and there was action there quite often. We all liked to watch the game, but the river was a special attraction. The water was much clearer than it is today, and right there in the middle of the park was a swimming hole and a big bathhouse. Just upstream, a ways from the bathhouse, was a swinging bridge, walkway across the river, and you kids liked to go out on that middle of the bridge and sit there with your legs hanging down, and you would watch and feed the big catfish in the water below them. Then came that exploratory ride all through the park, in which you had to cross the river two or three times. These crossings were fords and nice, smooth concrete. The water was fast and almost up to the running boards, and often the tires a bit smooth and the concrete a bit slippery. Added a bit to the fun. South end of the big park was the golf links, and it was here Mother and I learned to play golf. There was no fee for playing, and you could reserve a starting time for any day by registering ahead of time. After moving to the farm, we went on occasion to Corpus, and you kids thought it great fun. In those earlier years, there was no way to get to Padre Island, and everyone used the North Beach. Once we let Bill, the dog, go with us to Corpus, and he enjoyed it. Once while driving downtown, Bill was riding the running board, and on a U-turn right downtown, he fell off, and for a short time he was lost in the traffic. But we found him again, and after that he had to ride inside. One time in the early 30s, we were honored by a visit of some old friends from Illinois, Louis Sands, Chauncey Gloss, and Gene Clear. Lewis was a very good friend, and we used to play a lot of pool teaming up with his two brothers-in-law, Gene and Virgil Conley. Virgil and I were always teamed against his brother, Gene, and Louis. This was their first visit to Texas for our three visitors, and we wound up their visit by taking them to the Pier Cafe out on the pier at the end of People Street in Corpus. This was the thing to do and the place to go, and to do at that time in Corpus. treat them to a seafood dinner. But to Mother's disgust, after taking them so far for seafood, all they would order was ham and eggs. Chauncey and I both worked in a grocery store owned by Gene Clear's father. Gene owned a shoe store on the west side of the square at Mount Pulaski. Alfred also asked for descriptions of the first electric fence. Again, I don't recall the year, but it was back there when batteries were turned dry cells and were about the size of an ordinary iced tea glass and didn't last as long as these small models on today's market. These electric fences were brought out to serve as inexpensive temporary fences. After harvesting a crop, you could quickly run one of these fences around a field, turn the cows in, and they would clean it up. The fence was a single wire on heavy sticks, pounded into the ground and about waist high. Insulators on each post, of course, and as I recall, several of the dry cells. All animals soon learned to have great respect for those fences. The black bull, the governor, could not be held in by any fence. Usually he was tractable and easily handled, but when he wanted to go, he just walked right through a fence. The electric fence held him. He would not argue with it. I guess you three younger boys will remember the advent of the governor. We had quit milking cows and trying to raise calves for the market. Magazines from the North touted those black Angus bulls as a solution to this situation. The Angus calves would all be much superior to Jersey calves and look exactly like the sire. They were unknown here in South Texas. One day I was talking with a friend and brother Mason named Nunley here in Alice, and he solved our problem. He knew a colonel, somebody up in the hills of northwest Texas, who raised purebred Angus stock. Yes, but how do I get in touch with him, and will he bother with me wanting only one small calf and so far away? He answered, "You just don't worry. Leave it to me. The colonel's a good brother, Mason, and you'll get a good deal." In due time, the governor arrived with his papers. It was shipped to Fremont in a wooden crate by the railroad. Arrived in fine condition, and you kids loaded him crate and all into the trailer and took him home. Worked out fine. A few days later, I got the bill for him and mailed a check. We were really sorry to have to let him go when we left the farm, but this time Angus had become quite common around here, and he sold readily at the auction here in Texas Palace to another breeder. Another of Irene's ditties. Spaghetti may go for the day go, John Bull loves his cold beef and ale. The Hollanders wish for an ocean of fish, they eat them from herring to fray. The Irish go lean on potatoes and beans, the West French it's goose livers and wine. But give me Heine dear with his big stein of beer and the old German sausage for mine. Adam and Eve, they climbed a tree all around this world to see. What brought this on? That's all I know about it, but years ago, that was one of Dad's favorite outbursts to let off steam. Another was, thank heavens the table's set. This expletive came after a particularly arduous task had been completed and was used by the whole family. I told this to Evelyn once, and she adapted to it quickly. Every time a tedious job is finished, she will smile and repeat the phrase. This goes back to the time when we were kids growing up and did lots of reading of Winter Nights. The story was of a couple who were servants in a posh English estate. The gentleman servant was very correct and master over the maid, very exacting. It was difficult for her to do anything to please him at times. One afternoon, they were preparing for a grand gathering, and nothing had gone right. They had gotten to the preparations for the banquet, and both were frazzled. He corrected her on every move she made. Setting the table correctly was an ordeal. At the 11th hour, it was accomplished, and he passed approval. She, almost in tears, stepped back for a last look and exclaimed, "Thank heavens the table set." This he really objected to, and then they really had a quarrel. At my age, it's easy to look back and note the old discarded things of our youth now coming back as something new. The ceiling fan is one of the latest. I had one the earlier days in the studio here in Alice, but with the advent of air conditioning, it was never used and hung there, a dusty eyesore. One day, Morris and I took it down and gave it to Joe, who thought he might use it sometime. Now, if I had brought it home and stored it in the garage, we could be right back in style. Another is the acceptance of the wonderful new brass beds. When Mother and I first started out life together, I bought the latest thing in a new bed, shining brass with lots of gingerbread. If we had it today, we would be right back in style, but alas, it too passed by the wayside. We moved too many times. When I reached manhood's estate, and it was time for me to shave, or at least I thought it was, Dad presented me with a razor. This was the old straight razor. These modern safety models had not been invented yet, and I used it for a number of years. I haven't seen it in a long, long time, and I wonder if it's still around. Mother moved to town in 1942, and following the war, we remained very busy at the studio. Wasn't any gadding about, visiting, or social intercourse at all. One night we were sitting quietly reading the paper, and she exploded. I asked her what was bothering her, and did she complain? Nothing but work for so long, do nothing else, nor go no place. She wanted a change. I told her that sounded okay, but where or what did she want to do? She threw both hands in the air and answered, "Anywhere, any place, but let's do something." Reminded me of how we used to kid Ariel. All social projects were referred to as dog fights. And in her lexicon, any dog fight was better than no dog fight at all. I had just noticed an announcement in our local paper calling for students for a beginner's class of square dancing. This was being undertaken by a newly formed square dance club. How does this sound? Okay, doesn't matter what it is, but let's go. I had a very casual acquaintance with a few of the club members, so I called up and was urged to attend. So we went. We were conquered, and we stuck it out to the bitter end. We had lots of fun, made many new friends. We went to Corpus to visit and were drawn into the group presided over by Dr. Roger Knapp, Corpus City physician. This was a lot of fun, and we got into visiting all over this end of Texas. Our acquaintances widened. Eventually, we wound up at the top as far as Texas was concerned. We were invited to attend the seminars at A&M College, presided over by Manning Smith, a nationally known caller and teacher. Twice a year, the week during Christmas holidays and one week in midsummer, he would fill up that student memorial center with square dancers from all over the country. This was mainly for callers and teachers, which we weren't. But we knew a lot of these people and managed to hold our own with them, so it was a lot of fun. But getting back home, our club thrived wonderfully the first year, but as time went by, we lost so many of our leaders, teachers, and callers. The oil business had a way of transferring so many people. We had even acquired a plot of ground in the park out to the north end of town, paved the dance area, built a small brick building holding two restrooms with space between them for storage for music, records, and so forth. Had an 8-foot fence around it and some picnic tables and a bench down both sides. Nobody else had anything like that. We even went out there in cold weather and draped tarpaulins on the fence to shut off the breeze, built fires, and had hot coffee. We thought we were having a good time. But our club was losing out. We had a very good teacher, but he had to leave right in the middle of a class. Someone had to take over, and the finger was pointed at me. frankly, I wasn't too much of a success at it, but we kept up this part of it till the end. In the late 50s, square dancing declined all over the country, and our little club went kaput. It had been incorporated, so closing it up involved a bit of work. We divided up that equipment was left among those few left, turned the property back to the city. Then one day we heard of this Golden Age Club at Corpus, and we went to visit. Maybe we could learn something, come back home, start something. Well, it didn't work out that way. But we always had a lot of fun, have made many friends, and many, many memories. We still visit the ballroom dances in clubs at Rockport, Portland, and three different clubs in Corpus. Tanner even attends when I am able to go, and now square dancing is making a comeback, but so far I haven't succumbed. You know, I once described this house as old, and everything, including me, in it was also ancient. And does Evelyn bring this statement to a very sharp focus? Mother left two flower pots setting on the glass plates out in the yard. Carefully, Evelyn brings them in the house, gently scrubs them up. It seems these relics are termed Depression glass and worth some $18 each. She has a book from the library to prove it. She constantly picks out other items besides glassware to add to the list. I think she hit the jackpot yesterday. Pointing to the metal cowbells Mother brought from the farm and hung up in the kitchen, I had thought them a bit brassy hung there, but they were a gentle reminder of our lives on the farm. Proudly, Evelyn proclaims these bells are now very scarce and worth real money, especially the larger one that once hung on the governor's neck. It still holds the name tag, now a bit worse for wear, all printed in color and proudly proclaiming it was a Holstein bull bell and made by the Bloom Company, who are now out of business. This is a real collector's item in this cow country, and she proudly points to the book to prove her point. She also dug up a green glass cake dish and a toothpick holder and a salt and pepper shaker. All these she could point to in the book. Now she finds others she suspects but hasn't been able to prove up on yet. In time, you can expect to see the sign on the front door, Lobrex Antique Shop. I have now rung the bell for the antiques. Today I found an old clay flower pot resting in a beat-up old glass bowl under the edge of the house. Pot still full of dirt and the whole mess ready for the junk pile. So I took the glass bowl into Evelyn and jokingly told her I was consigning this mess to the garbage. Oh, no you don't. She grabbed it and into the hot, soapy dishwater it went. Came out looking different, and she called my attention to the brand name on the bottom of the plate. Pyrex. And just look at that blue cast in the glass. That blue cast is the deciding feature. She intends to get that library book back again. Gerard asks me to talk more about Dad's painting. I thought I had covered that subject. I had mentioned Mannheim as his teacher and his earlier work, but moving to Mount Pulaski and making a living for we four kids, he had 2 hours for following a hobby. Also, he had various other hobbies that were more pressing at the time, till along came the Depression and time hung heavy on his hands. He turned to his paintings and worked diligently, turning out all of the paintings he had seen. I think all, or most of the scenes he painted, were of localities in which he was familiar. The one big exception, of course, the place of his birth, Spike Holland. He told me once this was a figment of his imagination aided by an old, well-worn picture and the many stories and descriptions his father had related to him as a boy. This picture is my favorite of them all. Most of these others that I have are also very satisfying. They are scenes from the area around Ottawa and familiar to me also. Mother and I and you two older boys went there one time on a vacation. I said, yes, we went to airports several times to air shows while living in San Antonio. These were staged on Army fields in the San Antonio South Side. As these were our first experiences, they were a bit awe-inspiring and marvelous. However, one time we did witness a horrible accident, and that was frightening. After that, Mother refused to go again. Other than this, there's nothing I can tell. They had the most ridiculous item on TV the other day, a substitute for tobacco cigarettes for smokers wishing to give up tobacco. It was made from the hulls or pods of the cocoa bean and ground up and made into cigarettes. They showed users trying them, and their reception was quite cool. This was tried while I was a little boy, and it didn't work for them either. Only the kids played with it. Recall earlier I described the drugstore of that era. There were long shelves filled with many herbs, roots, seeds, nuts, dried fruit, and so forth. On one glass jar was the word Cuba, C-U-B-E-B. Sometimes spelled Q-U-B-A-B. This was a dried seed of an herb from the tropics. In those days, from the seed pod of the herb from the tropics. In those days, if you had a cold in the head and any nasal troubles, it was diagnosed as tar. And folklore medicine quickly indicated the smoking of cubab, which would clear away the trouble. They were very aromatic and effective. Remember, antihistamines, mentholatum, Whiskey and so forth wasn't yet on the market. Someone touted these cubab cigarettes as a cure for tobacco, and in those days it was harder for kids to buy tobacco, but anyone could buy cubab. Either leaf, or a pipe, or ready-made cigarettes. The kids went for them, but didn't last long for either the grown-ups or the kids. The other night, Evelyn, Gerard, and I were working a crossword puzzle. We were struck by a word described as something for ventilation. It finally came out to be a transom. But what in the world is a transom? Neither of them knew. Just another instance of being modern. I guess at the turn of the century, all houses were built with transoms, particularly on all outside doors. Right over the top of them, a long narrow window across the top of the door, hinged at the bottom and opened and closed by a steel rod that came down on the door facing near the doorknob. Always screened like the window. Usually these were in under a porch so they could be opened in a rainstorm. Sometimes in larger houses there were transoms between large rooms. We had them in our house in Mount Lost. Alfred asked about the 30-30 rifle we once owned. I don't recall how the trade was worked up, but we traded a small shot to Lee Franz for the rifle. We thought we needed something to shoot the pesky coyotes, and in season, maybe a deer. I don't recall it ever being used for deer hunting. Franz died not too long after this trade. About this same time, Bill Langman also died. Both had been World War I victims of gas attacks. A few years after Lee's death, his son Lee Jr. learned about a gun box. He had so little use for it, so it was sold back to him. I don't recall any details of the trade, but Lee Jr. was so happy to have his dad's gun back again. Mother and I, Tanner, and his three eldest boys made a trip to Lake Charles to visit Alfred and family. The kids were all small at that time. As we neared Orange in East Texas, thought awe-inspiring how good spring into view. It cuts right in the middle of the road if you approach it, and looks like it goes straight up into the world. The question arose, would we be able to make that climb? So Connor and I went into deep discussion as to whether we shouldn't turn back and not attempt it. To close the argument, as we got closer, I pointed to a number of cars parked on the approach to the bridge. Obviously, they were there because they just couldn't make it. The little boys were quite impressed and cheerful, for this was a serious business, but the spell was quickly broken as we neared the bridge. One of the boys spoke out so disgusted. Oh, Grandpa,
those cars across there so the people could go through them. And we went up and over the bridge easily. Gerard is responsible for this one. Goes back to our earlier years, some years, Howard's, the North Southern's, and other years, and this is one of the bad years. The mother had practiced shooting in the 30-30 rifle. She had young chickens all over the place, and one day a cow came up almost into the yard, grabbed one of those little chicks and made for the lagoon. She sang. This was before the brush had grown up on the slope down to the lagoon, and you could see clear across the lagoon. Mother grabbed her trusty rifle and headed for us. The ladder happened to be up against the house on the north side of the house, and up it she went to the roof where she could see the action. The coyote was just trotting along easily when she clapped down on him, and it was taken by surprise. She missed the close, and the coyote reared, and she shot again. Again a near miss, and the coyote reared again. She shot 4 or 5 times before he got across the lagoon and faced her. Talk about a frontier lady. She sure joined the ranks that day. Strange what you can do when angry and aroused to action. I wonder just how much longer I'm going to be able to keep this up. I'm running dry. Now, if any of you have got any ideas that I have left out, I sure wish you'd send them on to me, because I'm just about, well, Q-U-I-T.